If you think you're doing yourself right by buying your coffee from the grocery store or your local cafe, then you are suffering from Stockholm Syndrome. The true coffee lover knows that the secret to making the best coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans, and you can only be assured that you're starting with the freshest beans when you switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium fair trade Arabica beans. They offer blends of roast to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this beautiful coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it, so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. It's not a coffee of the month club. You will not be Sparkplug's prisoner. No, it's completely flexible and customizable. All the convenience, none of the commitment. Would you like an incentive to switch? Well, be our guest. Use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout for a 20% discount on your next coffee order. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Certain as the mail.
Certain as the mail.
Comes every day. The next lyric I don't know. I thought of this on the spot.
You didn't plan ahead.
Buy Sparkplug Coffee.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action!
Hello, children of all ages, and thank you for plunking the 380th Ellis's Analysis right smack in the middle of your day. Our early days reviewing old flicks had us analyzing the 123 AFI greats on their 1998 and 2007 lists. So to hear us talk about The Wizard of Oz, The Searchers, Easy Rider, Do the Right Thing, and so many more, you'll have to scroll way back. Keep on scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. The secrets of those films were spoiled. Beauty and the Beast will be packed with spoilers, too. I'm the loner who easily falls in love with pretty girls who dig reading, Ryan Ellis. And here's the feminist who can learn to love a terrifying monster only after he's dead, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
He's dead! So the curse is lifted, yet he's brought back to life, too.
In the How It Should Have Ended, the curse is lifted, he becomes a man, and then he's like, ow, I'm still stabbed!
I saw that probably. I forgot that they did that. I saw that probably years ago. I've seen everything they've ever done that I've seen of the movie. Same with Honest Trailers. Everything they've ever done where I've seen the movie. Saw their stuff more than once in many cases. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for Beauty and the Beast. La Belle et la Bête is the only animated movie to make the AFI's Top 100 Passions and Top 25 Musicals. There's only one other cartoon that ranked on either of those lists at all. And what was that?
It was Lady and the Tramp.
We're going to be singing this all day long, aren't we? One quick note about Lady and the Tramp, Beauty and the Beast. Every single lyric in that song has five syllables. Tale as old as time, certain it can be, Beauty and the Beast, etc. Lady and the Tramp has nothing to do with that, except that's the answer, you're right. And it has the same structure, five syllables. So Lady and the Tramp is the answer. It was 95th on the top 100 passions. I'm mildly surprised Snow White didn't make the top 25 musicals. And that other cartoons didn't make one of those two lists. But no, Beauty and the Beast. We'll get into the numbers in a few minutes. Man, there are a lot of AFI lists and other things it was honored by. So, you said it in the coffee sponsor, Stockholm Syndrome was released by Disney 30 years ago on November 22nd, 1991. What a hit. But Bev, since the movie is 30 years old now, please remind everyone what it's about with The Beauty and the Skinny.
It's France in the Middle Ages, and a young prince is suffering a witch's curse that has turned him into an ugly beast until he can find love despite his looks. When local girl Belle agrees to replace her father in the beast's dungeon, he treats her with contempt. But Belle looks at this terrifying rageaholic holding her captive and thinks, I can change him! And she does! The beast softens under Belle's gentle influence, and when he sacrifices himself to save them both from the local narcissist, the two express their love for one another and break the curse.
Lisa, many women will tell you that you can't change a man, and those women are quitters.
The other key thing, by the way, in the story of this movie is that she has to love him back unconditionally. It's not just that he has to love, but she has to love him back. All right, well, in a nutshell, Belle spends more time in the West Wing than Donald Trump did in his 4 years as president.
He's not president anymore.
We don't have to go on about it, but that man did not work much. And she's banned from going there. She goes there over and over again. And this story takes place in only a couple of days, too. A lot happens in, I don't know, maybe 3 days.
She can't even make it the whole first day without going in the West Wing.
Never go to the West Wing!
For no reason! She's just bored? I don't know. Where does this go? Oh, well.
If you agree to stay there as his prisoner, then you probably should do what he says. Of course, you're a prisoner. What worse? Oh, it could be worse, couldn't it? He could beat you. He could starve you. Well, he even says at one point, if she doesn't eat with me, she doesn't eat at all. Okay, let's get through all the numbers, then we'll get into the proper conversation. The critics, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 94% of them like the film, 110 fresh, 7 rotten, for an average of 8.5 out of 10. I'm thinking that Bad probably doesn't have that strong a feeling about this movie. And 92% of audiences. It was third at the 1991 U.S. box office. T2 was number one. We covered that so long ago. The Silence of the Lambs, the Best Picture winner, we covered that for the Top 100 Project, was number 4. And Thelma Louise was number 28. We covered that a couple years ago as well. The movie made about $440 million. I can't find the adjustment for inflation numbers, but I'm sure it's on the top 300 somewhere. The remake in 2017 is 77th adjusted for inflation, and the reviews weren't terrible. That's the one with Emma Watson and Dan Stevens playing the Beast, Watson playing Belle, directed by Bill Condon. This version, though, won 2 Oscars, Best Song and Best Score. This is right in the middle of Alan Menken's run of 8 total Oscars in a short period of time, because he won for Song and Score on Little Mermaid, Song and Score with this, Song and Score for Aladdin, and Song and Score for Pocahontas.
Is that back to back to back?
No, because you've got...
Is Lion King in between?
Lion King in there for one. Maybe that's the only one, actually, that breaks up that run. Every single time he was nominated, at least in those 4 movies, he
Woe
won.
Woe is you if you're a composer working during those years.
And of course, the song was Beauty and the Beast that won the Oscar. It was also nominated for 4 more. Best Picture, first time ever an animated film had been nominated for that, and only one of 3. The other 2 are, we've talked about this before.
Toy Story 3 mm-hmm. and Up.
That's right. It was also nominated for its sound. That's appropriate for any animated film because you have to create every single sound in the movie. And then Belle and Be Our Guest, which is great, were also nominated for the Oscar for Best Song. I think Be Our Guest is the best song in this movie. And apparently there's 25 minutes of music in this film, which is just blanketed with score and with the songs.
Yeah, they were trying to go for like a Broadway musical sound and feel. I think they achieved it.
Well, I'll ask you that right now. Did you like the music in this movie?
Yeah, the songs are amazing. They're not my speed. I remember Beauty and the Beast, the Celine Dion version. Celine Dion singing with Help Me Out.
Isn't it Peebo Bryson?
I remember it was on the radio constantly. It was such a big song. It's just not my jam, but I can't deny that it's a beautiful song. As I get older, I like the Angela Lansbury version much more.
I think it's more fitting in the story, because of course the Celine version plays in the end credits, and that's the one that everyone thinks of, I think. Well, most people probably do. That's specifically what won the Oscar, I guess you'd argue. And when Menken won the Oscar, he of course thanked Howard Ashman, his partner of many years, I think Little Mermaid they worked on and many others, who had died during the production of AIDS. Mm-hmm. But he thanked, Menken did, both Lansbury and Celine for singing it in 2 different versions. And I wonder, same thing about Lion King. I think we talked about that years ago when we covered that movie. Had it been the Elton John version that plays, everyone, again, thinks of that. That's what won the Oscar. Timon and Pumbaa sing that song in the actual story. And that's the one that fits better. It's the same as this. Lansbury singing it with her fine voice, but not Celine Dion voice. Maybe fits the tone better at that moment.
Yeah, and she's singing it in character. Her voice is kind of creaky and old. It has a ton of character, but she still can hit the notes. But mostly she just sings with this really beautiful, authentic emotion. She didn't want to do the song when they told her that they wanted Mrs. Potts to be the singer of this song. She fought back and she was like, I just don't have a strong enough singing voice. And they were like, well, just humor us and do a take. Go in the studio, sing it, and then we'll see if we can work with it or not. And so she goes in the studio, she does a take, as legend tells. And by the time she finished singing the song, everyone in the studio was in tears, and they didn't even do a second take. The take that she recorded then is the take that wound up in the movie and the take that won an Oscar for Best Song.
Peebo Bryson does sing with Celine in the end, by the
way. Thank you.
I just checked it. Yeah, it's a beautiful song, but I still do prefer Be Our Guest.
No, Be Our Guest is kind of a banger, right?
In the history of Disney. That's saying something. See my best.
And then this year somebody did Wear a Mask. The lyrics are very clever. It's a really tight, just joke a minute. Mm. Joke a second. Which is the same about the original version of this song. The lyrics are really clever and it's very dense. So you kind of have to listen to it a few times. And each time you listen to it, you may catch a new detail of clever wordplay and rhyme. Mm.
I love the touch where they make the Eiffel Tower out of the dishes and silverware. Did you notice that? I don't think I'd ever noticed that before.
No,
but
I didn't.
Loved noticing it this time.
No, I didn't notice it.
Beautiful touch. Yeah, it's in the background somewhere when all the dishes are dancing and everything.
In France, where everybody speaks with American accents, except Lumiere and the Feather Duster, who speak with outrageous French accents.
And Jerry Orbach is as American as it gets, too.
Ask me when I learned that Jerry Orbach plays Lumiere.
Just today?
Yesterday. Yeah. I had no idea. I saw that on the Wikipedia page, and I double-checked the same Jerry Orbach.
Mm-hmm. The Law and Order guy for all
yeah,
those
years. Yeah, yeah. Baby's dad. And
right, which we covered last year or 2 years ago, maybe. Yeah, hundreds of episodes of Law and Order. That's the thing he's probably best known for. And then this movie, maybe. By the way, the previous musical that was nominated for Best Picture was All That Jazz. What's that, 12 years earlier? And the next one was Moulin Rouge, which was 10 years later. And this is a business that honored musicals many times over in the past. Wizard of Oz was nominated all those years ago. Then again, the greatest musical of all time, Singin' in the Rain, was not nominated for Best Picture, but it should have been. And it would be if you could go back and change history. Okay, again, back to the numbers. National Film Registry in 2002 for Beauty and the Beast, only 1 year after it could have been, because it's 10 years you have to wait. We've covered these four, From Here to Eternity and In the Heat of the Night, both went in that year. They're top 100 project films. And Alien and Boys in the Hood we covered. Boys in the Hood also 1991, so 1 year after it could have made it. It did make it into Congress. It's being protected. B&B, 62nd on the top 100 songs. Over the Rainbow is number one. Of course, Beauty and the Beast being that song, but it should be our guest. Wait, that's not on the songs list then, I guess, is it? No, it was nominated. I see in my notes here. It was nominated, but didn't make it. The movie was 34th on the top 100 passions. We talked about that already. Casablanca was number one. It was 22nd on the top 25 musicals. Singin' in the Rain was number one. And it was 7th on the top 100 genres. In the animation category, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was numero uno. And I mentioned already, Be Our Guest was nominated for top 100 songs. Should have made that list. Top 50 heroes, Belle. Not really a hero, but okay. I'm not against it.
I could defend it.
And it was nominated for the main lists, the 1998 and 2007 top 100s. There weren't a ton of cartoons that were nominated for that, and only three in total made those 123 choices. Fantasia, Toy Story, and the original, the greatest, probably, animated film of all time, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Okay, after all of that, what do you think of Beauty and the Beast?
Meh. You kind of gave it away earlier. I don't know why. This movie just doesn't do much for me. It didn't, even when it came out, I was 13 years old and definitely still in the Disney demographic. And I loved Lion King and I think I liked Aladdin pretty good and loved Little Mermaid. So I don't know what it was that just didn't move me. It's beautiful. I'm old enough to remember that wow factor of that blend of classical animation and some pretty brand new CGI effects. The songs are classics now, but they really are so beautiful. I can intellectually appreciate Beauty and the Beast, and I'm not in the club of people who wants to pile on it for being problematic, even though, yeah, it's kind of problematic, I guess, but by 1991 standards, it's not that bad.
Well, you're also not raving about it, too. So I thought this was going to say you're not in that group of people that loves this, the greatest animated film of all time. I think it was Michael Eisner when they did the DVD release of this, probably in 2002 or something like that, 2001, whatever it was, that said it's the greatest Disney movie of all. If it wasn't the greatest, it was one of, he thought. I wouldn't put it even in the top five, but he did.
People do. People put it in the number one list of animated films of all time. And I'm not going to deny its beauty.
Fitting.
But Disney films, even when I was a kid, I wasn't the biggest Disney kid, so.
I mentioned 2002 is maybe when this movie was honored with a DVD release, and that's when I heard that interview with Eisner. I know for sure 2002 is when I saw it on the big screen as a re-release, and it was quite an experience. I saw a lot of movies that year that got re-released. I'd forgotten. I was looking at my old notes. Apollo 13 was re-released that year. I don't know why, 7 years later, but it was. In IMAX, and shorter, though. We covered that movie last year, of course, but the proper version of it. Amadeus, also a strange year to get re-released, not a 20-year anniversary, but anyway, saw that. And then E.T., which was a 20-year anniversary that got re-released in 2002. But let's get back to the problematic elements you seem to have with the movie.
No,
at least you're
I don't.
Mentioning other people do, but what are they?
Well, you said at the beginning, the whole Stockholm Syndrome thing. I think a lot of people are like, this isn't a romance, this is Stockholm Syndrome, this is a woman reacting to abuse. The Beast behavior is bad. It's pretty irredeemable, and it's kind of absurd that anybody with their head on their shoulders would trust him after the way she meets him.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty twisted, but it's a fairy tale. So why does she fall in love with him? I know I made the joke about Belle seeing this damaged beast as a project, like a man she can fix. But I really don't think that's what's happening here. She's not trying to fix the beast. She's just trying to make the best of an arrangement that she agreed to. She doesn't guide him towards better behavior. He is the one with the character arc. Mm-hmm. He is genuinely motivated by his own growing regard for her. She leads by example, and he finds that he simply wants her to like him. And he wants to be a good enough man for Belle. She's never afraid of him, even though she absolutely should be.
And he's terrifying.
She should be much more scared. And he's trying to scare her, which is where I say, obviously he changes, but the way he behaves in the beginning of the film is pretty next level. I wouldn't show my daughter this film. Let's put it that way. Yeah, I don't think so.
I think kids...
There's so many better movies.
Kids probably watch this movie as much as the other ones, the other big ones.
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. I think lots of girls, especially girls my age, I'm 43... Somebody a little bit younger than me was raised on this movie, surely. But I like that even though he tries to scare her with his temper, she really doesn't put up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes, blow off your steam. Temper tantrums, they don't really have a big effect on me. Because she begins the film pretty self-actualized. Like I said, she has no arc. She sees through Gaston's looks. She could care less about the way her personality quirks are viewed by her neighbors. And that attitude is what thaws out the beast, too. She doesn't really approach him with judgment. He expects her to treat him the same way he's treated by everybody else who sees him as a monster. But she's already evolved. She takes him at face value and judges him on his behavior, which he then changes to meet her and become beautiful on the inside because he is the one with the arc. And you were saying, does she belong on the heroes list? She saves her father, and just through being stalwart and evolved and good-natured, she saves the beast.
I guess just as important, she saves all the enchanted objects and turns them back into people, too.
It's pretty twisted how much the beast could care less about his staff.
Mm-hmm. My original nutshell, incidentally, is why did the hag curse the staff, too? They were just trying to earn a living.
She's the villain of the film. If you do the math, Beast was 11...
This is debatable.
People go back and forth. In the animation, when they do the flashback, he looks like an adult. But they're like, the curse has lasted for 10 years, and on his 21st birthday, the rose will start wilting. I can do math.
I don't think they say 21st birthday specifically, necessarily, because you're right. He looks like he's at least a young adult. But I think it's Lumiere who says something like, we've been wasting away here for all these years. But that could have been before, because obviously Adam is apparently his actual name, the Beast. Adam looked like he was a bit of a putz and a jerk to other people, too, not just this woman. The hag ended up being a beautiful person, too, the reverse of Snow White, where she wants to be fairest in the land, so I'll make myself look hideously ugly. And like we asked in that podcast all those years ago, had her plan worked, does she get to be beautiful again, or is she going to be ugly forever? The queen in Snow White, I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, good question.
Well, on this, you've got a woman pretending to be a hag. Same thing. But we learn in the prologue she's actually beautiful, and that's why he's being judged badly for judging her.
Don't you think that he maybe made a good call? Because it turns out she's a pretty terrible person who meant him harm.
With some serious power.
Maybe don't let her in your house. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's seen Snow White knows not to let haggard old women mm-hmm. offering a weird gift in your house.
Yep. And he'll be a beast, yeah. But look at the real estate. That is one huge castle.
Got that library.
Our west wing is 5 feet of the house, I think. The east wing, the west wing.
West wing is the bathroom. That's about it.
So yes, he earns scorn by treating her badly, but that's a lot harsh, not a little harsh. And to do that to his people, to turn them into the objects they are, whether it's 10 years, whatever it is, we have a short period of time before all of them are cursed to be like this forever. So he should care more about his objects. And they are motivated, but they should be more motivated to get him to love somebody and make this work than they even are. And they are motivated. Of course, they can't make him do anything, I guess. None of them have real physical power, especially compared to him. The other thing that's been brought up 1,000 times is Chip.
Oh my God.
He's just a little kid we learn at the end when they're all human again. And his mother, Mrs. Potts, looks like she's a senior citizen.
Yeah, she's a little old lady. He looks like he's 5 when he becomes a human
again. So it can't have been 10 years right there. That proves that.
Yeah, I don't understand. He has 30 brothers and sisters all living in a cupboard.
No one cares about them.
Do they come back to life? Mrs. Potts doesn't care. What about your 29 other children?
Not a good mother.
She's a terrible mother.
So when the movie starts, we're seeing, I don't know if you see it through the whole film, but I definitely noticed in the opening shots that they're using the multi-plane cell technique. They did it in Snow White. I'm sure they did in most of their classic films. And now everything's digital. Every once in a while, a movie is hand-drawn. I guess Studio Ghibli in Japan still does things that way, but it isn't just Pixar now. It's all the animation for Disney that is computers. But this was the drawings, and I like the multiplane thing. It does give the shots a lot of depth. And when we meet Belle, you talked about her, I don't give a hoot what you think about me attitude, including to the women and girls. It's not just the men in the neighborhood, in her town. Her ville, if you will, being French. But her favorite book she talks about sounds a lot like the adventure she's about to go on.
Her ville, that she hates. Belle, she's so peculiar. She reads books.
She's not peculiar.
No. And there is an insane number of really beautiful women in this town. Oh, yeah. Like those three sisters, so hot for Gaston that their gigantic knockers are about to pop out of their peasant dresses.
I guess that's Mary Kay Bergman, says Bimbette here on the IMDb.
Bimbette! Her name is Bimbette!
So she must voice them all. And Mary Kay Bergman is the original woman voice on South Park. We talked about that in the movie we did last year. And she killed herself, I think, before the movie, or maybe, no, it must have been after the movie came out. Now you've got multiple people playing the women voices. But in the early days of South Park, the TV show, Mary Kay Bergman did all the girls and lady voices. Maurice's invention, I like how they bring that back as well later, because somehow Chip, who doesn't have any hands or arms or legs or anything else, can make that invention that chops wood for you work later on to save Maurice and Belle, who are trapped in their own basement. But Maurice takes that invention to the fair, gets lost in the woods. The horse bolts. Philippe, the smartest character in the whole movie, probably. Knows where to go to get home. Knows where to go to get back to a place it never really went to. Did it actually get... It didn't, did it? Get to the castle. Yet it knows to take Belle there. But it bolts. The wolves also a payoff because they come after her father and then later on they come after her when she tries to leave.
And there's an alternate ending that they didn't end up using where Gaston survives his fall and then gets eaten by wolves. But they were like, maybe a little too much for
the
kids.
They did it in Lion King then instead because
with the hyenas.
Scar should have died from the height he fell, which isn't nearly as far as what Gaston does here. But yeah, they paid it off there instead. So the wolves are surrounding that castle. But Maurice is taking refuge in the castle. It's the only reason he even ends up in there in the first place. And Be Our Guest was supposed to be a song for him because the objects are so thrilled that anyone's in this castle. But of course, he's not the one the beast is going to fall in love with. Although that's sexist. Why not? Why can't it be a gay relationship? But they didn't want to waste that great song, and it is such a great song, on that character, a secondary character who we don't care nearly as much about as we do Belle. Robbie Benson is the beast. They did deepen his voice electronically, I think, but he's been doing this, meaning show business, for a very long time. He's been working for over 50 years. He does act, and I don't know if he did a whole lot of voiceover animation. Paige O'Hara, who plays Belle, didn't work that much either. Only three movies for her in total, but she's a Broadway actress. Benson directed Friends a few times, some of those episodes, and he's directed three movies. And like I said, 50 years in the business is a long time. And then Paige O'Hara, who's Belle, I think does a great job, just like Benson does, but they never used her again for any of their major movies anyway. They wanted Jodie Benson, who I think is no relation to Robbie Benson, I don't think so, who was the Little Mermaid, to do this. I don't know why they didn't use her. But then they don't really reuse their voices that much, other than Hanks and Alan in the Toy Story sequel. There are other characters in those movies, but as the leading characters, they don't really recast people. Matthew Broderick didn't ever work with them again that I'm aware of, from Lion King, or Mel Gibson after Pocahontas.
Well, they make their princesses remarkably alike in a great many ways, so it definitely is smart to switch up their voices. I read that they didn't go with Jodie Benson because they just wanted a more grown woman voice. And Paige O'Hara certainly has just a more mature voice, because she is supposed to be grown up, whereas Ariel, she's a teenager. She's really supposed to have that youthful energy. Okay, right. She's immature and a little bit naive, but that's not really the case with Belle, so I get how it's good casting, but I mean, if you were to take away their hair and their outfits and just look at their faces and maybe even take away the skin tone, I don't think there's very much difference in the way they draw these characters from one movie to the next.
I read this is the first brunette in the history of the Disney princesses. They always had black hair girls and mostly blondes.
And she has brown eyes or hazel eyes, but she doesn't have blue eyes.
And at one point in the movie, I said to you, they did draw those very well. Her eyes in one close-up are beautiful, even though it's animated and she's completely made up. Beautiful eyes.
I remember reading they had some resistance to making Frozen because all the animators were resisting having two female leads because it would double their work because they can't let their women characters look ugly. They have to find all these workarounds for giving them expressions and have them do performances without ever looking, not for one single frame, unattractive, which is such a twisted, crazy thing. But ever since I read that, I've been paying attention to that whenever I see these Disney films, and I was looking at Belle, and it's true, there's not a frame where she doesn't still look very pretty.
Apart from Beast here, how many men? Okay, the dwarves, I guess. from way back when. But in the modern era, most of the male characters are beautiful, too.
But they're allowed to have goofy expressions on their face. They can have, like, more true expression.
Well, LeFou in this is a good example. Jesse Cordy. Obviously supposed to be foolish. It's in his name. And I think the Mel Gibson character, I know people hate him, but he is the voice in Pocahontas. He has comedy moments, but I don't believe she does. That might be the most beautiful character Disney ever drew was Pocahontas. So Richard White is the other big three in this movie, the love triangle. He's a stage actor also, like O'Hara. Somehow this is the only movie he ever did in any way. I don't know how you don't use this guy, especially because all three of them are great in this movie with their voices. I think he might be the best as Gaston, and they never put him in a movie again. And he only did a tiny bit of TV. He just pretty much works on Broadway. It must be his choice, because how do you not hear this movie, even if it's 20 years down the road, if you're Pixar, they have so many characters, and you think, let's get Richard White to play somebody, whether it be funny or a big, booming, bad guy.
And I think that the things that make you a good stage actor are the things that make you a good animation voice, because in both cases you have to project every emotion so that people who are in the cheap seats still know exactly what's going on. It's amazing how much harder it is than it looks to do voice work, to express emotions with your voice loud enough that people can see it when they hear it.
We mentioned Orbach. David Ogden Stiers is his buddy Cogsworth. They battle through the film in funny ways. He's done many Disney voiceover roles and also a lot of Woody Allen films. Definitely character actor here. Angela Lansbury, we said already. The villain in The Manchurian Candidate, one of the great films from the Top Notch Project way back when.
One of my faves.
Murder, She Wrote, like Orbach, her biggest thing overall, maybe apart from this film, is being on TV in a long-running series. So pretty good voice cast and not really relying on famous voices, which they didn't until the year after this when they did Aladdin with Robin Williams. And Williams didn't want himself to be promoted because he didn't want the movie to be about Robin Williams. Even he knew better. It should be about the movie itself. But since then, way more often than not, the lead in a Disney animated film was a star. Getting Mel Gibson in 95 was huge. And then Tom Hanks, that's not Disney so much, I guess. But most of the time, they have big names. But Little Mermaid didn't rely on that. This movie didn't rely on that.
Strictly for marketing. Because you cannot convince me that the stars' performances are better. And many times, I think, especially if you get somebody who's not really a comedy actor, then it can bring a movie down. Why would you stunt cast in animation? It's crazy how much they do it that everybody has to be a big star in an animated film now. I mean, look at the remake of Beauty and the Beast, the 2017 live-action version of it. You're never going to see Ewan McGregor, except for the last 5 minutes of the film, but you cast Ewan McGregor to play Lumiere.
No, you hear his voice the whole movie, though.
I haven't seen it, so I don't know if he was good or not. I can't believe that movie's 2.5 hours long. That is criminal to me.
This movie's an hour shorter.
What did you add that was so necessary? It's a children's movie.
I can think of a thing they probably did. They probably had more reaction shots of both Maurice and Belle being horrified that they're in an enchanted castle, and all these objects are talking to them.
They're very chill about it.
They take it in stride.
It's true. They were like, what's up, talking candlestick? Are you going to make me dinner? Radical.
How are you going to do that? But then Beast, I could see kids being scared by him, and you said you wouldn't show this to a little girl. The animator Glenn Keane, it's his crowning achievement, I guess, in all of his animating. I guess he worked for a long time. He's very proud of it. He combined many animals.
He's not really that ugly. Do you think he's actually ugly?
No, exactly.
Ugly?
That's true. He looks weird because he is so many different animals, but he's not ugly. It's
true. He looks like an animal, but he's a handsome animal. The live-action Beast is actually harder on the eyes. But the animated Beast, I wouldn't say cute necessarily, but he has a presence.
And he can obviously be pretty likable. He changes pretty fast because most of what we see happens in about a day. Her father going off, getting captured, she goes and finds him. And I think it's just nighttime when she has dinner with him, reluctantly. The next day she tries to get out of there and he saves her. So that's about halfway through the movie and that's been maybe 24 hours. This has been asked by thousands of people, including us now, how in the world did Little Belle get the Beast on her horse to get back to the castle?
By the convenience of editing. And clock wipe. Yeah. And they're in the castle.
I thought maybe Beast saving Belle from the wolves the way he does, because she would have been killed by them, was homaged in King Kong in 2005, the Peter Jackson version, when Naomi Watts finally starts to like and maybe even fall in love with, not sexually fall in love with, Kong, because he saves her life against the T-Rexes. And this, Belle doesn't fall in love with him in that moment, but she learns to appreciate him because he saved her from death. And then he simply says, that's one of the first moments he softens, thank you, not thank you, it's thank you for helping me out and getting me back here. after he took a beating from those wolves.
Because he does that, I think that's not necessarily when she falls in love with him. It's when she resolves to make good on her promise to stay. Say, okay, well, he's not actually a monster, so I said I would stay here forever in exchange for my father's freedom.
The next day, I'm gone.
But then she's like, okay, I'll stay. She falls in love with him then because she's making the best of her situation.
If she loved him then, he would have changed right then. She didn't love him then.
No, she falls in love with him over the course of...
But she truly loves him when she's weeping over his dead body. And not only is the curse gone, but he's back to life. We talked about the songs in this movie being awesome, but the one I don't love that much, even though Richard White does a great job singing it, is Gaston's song in the bar, bragging about how great he is.
Ah, so funny. I can't believe you don't like it.
It's not bad. It's just not as good as the other songs. And I don't think it's necessary.
I love the wordplay in it.
That's true.
So jaunty.
Still don't like it that much, though. Contrast to Be Our Guest and Beauty and the Beast. Doesn't stick in my mind the way the other ones do. Another homage, probably, from Frankenstein, is when the posse forms and they go after the Beast, who's misunderstood at worst and not a villain at all, really. Well, what he's doing to Belle and what he was going to do to her father by imprisoning them for simply trespassing because Maurice was going to get killed by the wolves and she went to find her father. So they didn't do anything that was all that bad. So I guess the Beast isn't completely innocent. But they're going to have to kill him.
The internet pointed out that it's pretty absurd that you're punishing somebody because they sought food and shelter in your home. How dare you? As your punishment, I will provide food and shelter in my home for the rest of your days. Just send him back out to the wolves. Mm-hmm.
Get out of my house, yeah. Well, there's a part of him that wants someone to be there, no matter how they're there, I think, because he's been alone so long. The objects want him there, too.
But yeah, so the villagers come with their pitchforks and torches. Truly, everyone in that village is the worst, except for Maurice and Belle. They are just universally awful. They all think Gaston is the man, just because he's handsome, I guess.
And this beast that's lived outside of their town all this time has never bothered them, but now he has to die because they're aware of him.
The theme of the movie, of course, is about recognizing inner beauty and not paying attention to how things look on the outside because that doesn't tell you what you need to know. The Beast is ugly outside but becomes beautiful inside. Gaston is, of course, the total opposite. He is beautiful outside but an ugly monster on the inside.
Every inch of him covered with hair except he has almost no hair other than what's on his head. And his chest. No arm hair, no sideburns, no beard.
When they originally designed his character, they thought that he was going to be like a fop, you know, a dandy, and very vain in that way. And he is still vain, but instead they went for this much more masculine...
He's huge.
...ideal of a man, the kind that townspeople would be impressed by. Not just impressed by himself, but impressive enough to fool everybody else.
And to stand toe-to-toe with the Beast when they have a fist fight. Of course, the Beast doesn't want to live. He seems like he's more than happy if... Gaston just stabs him the way he does and kills him until he realizes, wait, Belle's here and I gotta save her. How dare you? All this kind of stuff. He's not really fighting back at first. But the enchanted objects are. They kick some heavy-duty booty on that posse.
I'm pretty sure the wardrobe killed somebody.
Yeah.
I want to praise the animation of the objects. I guess it's an animator's dream because it's something you truly can only do in animation is to bring inanimate objects alive. I think they do it so well that it looks invisible. Mm-hmm. You think about Be Our Guest and they're all dancing. How does a plate dance? Mm-hmm. It doesn't even have a single moving part. Lumiere has no legs and yet you can tell he's doing a can-can. How is it that they nailed these movements and made these objects look so alive? Mrs. Potts is just a face. And yet, I can believe that she is walking, that her teacup son is operating heavy machinery. One of her many, many teacup sons that I guess she gave birth to through her spout. I don't know. Mm.
The real villain in this movie is Monsieur Dark. I forgot about him until looking at his name right here in the IMDb. Tony J. He seems to set all this in motion because Gaston is the villain. But really, it's Monsieur Dark who sets them on their way to go kill this beast. I don't really know what his motivations are enough. But Maurice will be committed if Belle doesn't marry Gaston. Killing the beast is almost irrelevant because if she just says yes to marrying him or is forced into it, like in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, maybe, same year as this, Gaston gets what he wants and him and the other people in this town don't seem to care what Belle wants.
No. Another parallel that he has with the beast that they both basically get Belle's attention by imprisoning her father. The person that she cares about the most.
But the Beast loves her enough to let her go. However, he could have helped her find her father. He could have gone too.
Another thing they pointed out in How It Should Have Ended, oh, I wish I could see my father. He's sick. He might be dying. She always thinks he's dying. He's lost in the woods. He's probably going to die. Yeah, it's okay. He can just go to bed and drink some tea. He'll be fine. She wants to see her father, and then in the How It Should Have Ended, the beast is like, he can live with us. It's a giant house. The townspeople don't really love him. He can build his inventions here in the castle.
If I may quote pitch meeting, super easy, barely an inconvenience.
Oh, that would make really? So much sense. Why go back to town? There's a solution to this.
They don't want to live there anyway. At least she doesn't, really. So yeah, Gaston and the Beast fight to the death in a fierce rainstorm. And that's, of course, why Maurice ends up in the castle earlier, because of a fierce rainstorm. And then the stab happens. I already asked if the Beast can be resurrected, and obviously he can, but that's one of the many fantasies in this fantasy movie. Speaking of fantasies, it's based on a fairy tale. Cocteau made a French movie in 1946 called, I've already referenced it, La Belle et la Bête. And that's more true to the fairy tale than this is. I don't think there's any enchanted objects in a castle or anything like that.
No, but Belle et la Bête introduced a lot of the peripheral characters that they borrowed for Beauty and the Beast.
So this movie, you mean?
Yeah, because the original fairy tale, there's just the two of them. There's no Maurice, there's no Gaston.
Okay. There's a straight-to-video sequel in 1997, The Enchanted Christmas is what it was called, Beauty and the Beast, The Enchanted Christmas. Never saw it. Obviously, it didn't succeed if it's straight to video in the sense of box office, but there it is.
Oh, Disney knows how to make money in home media.
And I didn't know about this till looking yesterday. A 2014 French adaptation with Vincent Cassel and Léa Seydoux. You mentioned the blockbuster in 2017 with Watson and Stevens. The Broadway show that started in 1994. Over 5,000 performances, and it lasted for over 13 years.
I didn't know that they did this on Broadway. Mm-hmm. The Lion King, obviously I knew, but I had no idea that Beauty and the Beast was also...
I think a lot of animated films have ended up being on Broadway at some time or another. I can't think of one right now, but I'm sure there's others. So we haven't mentioned the directors at all, which aren't as relevant in an animated film as a lot of other films, because they're just one part of a... That's always true, I know, but they're just part of a team behind the scenes leading it rather than being the auteur like a Scorsese or somebody. But Gary Trousdale and Kirk Wise, co-directors, worked together three times. They haven't made that many movies. And you look at their credits, they haven't made much of anything since 20 years ago. I don't know why that is when they make a movie like this and other things that were okay, but this was such a blockbuster. This is Trousdale's first ever film. They worked on Hunchback of Notre Dame, for example, in 96, which was not a big hit, as I recall.
Kind of a similar theme, too. He's actually ugly, the Hunchback. Yes, they actually draw him ugly, and he's in love with a beautiful woman.
Mm. The only writer credited is Linda Wolverton, who worked on The Lion King, which we covered a couple years ago, but there are a lot of story credits. 10 people have story credit, including Joe Ranft, who ended up working with Pixar, and his name is in Soul, I believe. He's one of the little name tags that, 22 had been? 22 or 21? Why am I forgetting 22. This? 22 had been before. I noticed it right away because Joe Ranft is a name that just stands out. He's also the voice of Wheezy in Toy Story 2. And Chris Sanders also has a writing credit. He's the guy that did How to Train Your Dragon and some other films. So they went on to do bigger things after being just part of the team in this one. Producer was Don Hahn, worked on The Lion King and Hunchback of Notre Dame. And then Howard Ashman had an executive credit, but he died before it even came out. He apparently was brilliant. He was the lyricist of these songs and the Little Mermaid songs, and I think other ones before that. And Menken was the guy who wrote the music, but they were a great team together. The movie's 185-1. We watched it on Disney Plus, although we do have the DVD. It looked pretty great, I thought. The editor, John Carnahan, probably. Mostly has worked in animation, including The Simpsons movie, one of the editors on that. And I mentioned Alan Menken and his credits and also his many Oscars. You said the music you thought was pretty good. What about the pace, the cutting and all that, and the look of this film? Well, I guess we said the animation was excellent.
So I love that it is fast-paced. It really has the same sort of pacing and story as all the movies of the Renaissance. They made them really quick. They didn't linger on emotional beats. The plot moves along. Now, watching it as an adult, I wish it had more breathing room. I really needed to see Belle relax in the castle. I really needed to see certain moments happen that don't, but I don't remember that bothering me as a kid, and maybe that was because of the time it was made and because I was a kid. But it's hard to argue with the pacing of the story. It really moves. You're never bored. It flies by. That hour and a half is over in a minute. And I know that they cut a lot out. They cut out a whole song.
Human Again, which is on Broadway. I'm pretty sure that they did
it's
that.
It's on there. Broadway, and I think it's in the 2017 film.
Sounds right. That's one reason it's so much longer.
They obviously had no limit on how long they wanted to make that movie. And I think they even released it on home media before that, a version of it. You can find it on YouTube.
To be human again. as if we don't know they want to be human again. I don't think you notice that the events in the movie take place in a short period of time until you've seen it repeatedly. The first time I saw this, I never thought about it. It doesn't even really matter that much, but I'm sure I didn't notice that, oh my God, all these things happen in what seems like a couple of minutes.
I think they understand that they're making movies for kids and that kids don't care about logical fallacies in storytelling. If you have enough forward momentum to make them invested in whatever's happening now and whatever's happening next, they're not going to nitpick about that kind of thing.
That's true. What happens next? Well, Belle prefers the big hairy guy, so they go their separate ways. And the enchanted objects are now just regular people, so they all quit, and they're going to find another work somewhere.
Yeah, I'm going to go work for somebody that doesn't leave me languishing in a candle body.
For so long. In the middle of nowhere.
When they all turn human again and we see what they look like, of course Mrs. Potts is way too old to have a very young son. Also, Lumiere is way too goofy looking to be with that hot feather duster, because when we see her, she is a babe. She is a 10, and he is punching way above his weight.
The other what happens next, by the way, other option, I should say, is that Belle loves Beasts or Adams Library so much that she sticks around until she read every single book, and then maybe she bails if she doesn't actually love him, although the movie implies they're in love. But if she doesn't love him, she's got to read all those books first, so she's going to be there till she dies anyway.
On her 95th birthday, she just closes the last book and leaves. He doesn't even remember who she is anymore.
It is fitting we cover this movie in one big way, though. You're a big reader, not so much of physical books anymore. Not many people really do that.
What's the difference?
But you read a book on a regular basis, and I have anger management issues.
And I endure it and forgive you all the time.
And love me anyway.
Bring me definitely back getting better about just letting you roar and roar it out and ignoring you.
Well, one quick thing about the feminist issues that I guess a lot of people probably have with this movie is, one, people didn't think this way. That may not be good enough for a lot of people now, but 30 years ago, people didn't think the same way they do now. And Belle was more of her own person, certainly than The Little Mermaid was 2 years before. And that was
a beloved
film.
She was a huge improvement. I mean,
more than Snow White was.
We rewatched Little Mermaid recently, and I was impressed at how much, not progressive it was, but people really dump on Little Mermaid for being a super sexist film. On the surface, if you see the plot, you're like, yeah, but when you watch the movie, she is a character with a fair amount of agency who's naive and makes a dumb decision, not really realizing what she's doing. She gets talked into something. But just like Beauty and the Beast, it wasn't as sexist as I was expecting it to be. And yes, when you compare these characters to the princesses of classic Golden Age Disney, Belle is a huge improvement. She is self-actualized. She's very intelligent. She doesn't care what other people think. She may be beautiful, but it's the last thing in the world she cares about. And when she falls in love with Beast, it's because of the person inside. It's because of his humanity inside, and not because of his money and his giant library, and because he's going to be handsome.
She saw something that wasn't there before. The castle, too, is something I don't think I noticed the first time I saw this movie, that it is also transformed.
Yeah, it's just something
gargoyles
ugly.
Gargoyles and ghouls and things, and it's very dark. But originally, the opening, we see it briefly, and then at the end,
the gargoyles,
there's
the
cherubs,
yeah.
And that kind of thing. So yeah, people can tear apart these old movies for not being woke, but I don't think this one really fits that mold the same way that some of the other ones maybe do.
And like I said, if I had a daughter, probably wouldn't show her this movie. Don't love Frozen either, but I would definitely make that a regular in my household if I was raising. Actually, and a son, too. Because I especially wouldn't want my son to see Beauty and the Beast, because the Beast is actually a far worse example of behavior than Belle is. Belle is an excellent role model. Beast is terrible, and he gets away with his terrible behavior until he finally comes around to changing.
And he gets what he wants for the right reasons, because he's finally a good guy and fights to the death to save her. But if he had never been turned into a beast, would he have had the same kind of heart? He did learn a lesson. It took many years, but the hag taught him a lesson in the end.
It's all about forgiving your abuser. That's the real theme of this movie.
If somebody knocks on our door and demands to be let in, and if we don't, they'll curse us. They're absolutely the bad guy, and we don't deserve that. We don't have to take somebody into our house, even if it is bad weather out there. Well, this isn't my favorite cartoon of all time. It's not nearly as funny as some of Disney's best. Snow White's pretty funny a lot of the time, and Lion King has a lot of humor with Timon and Pumbaa, especially Aladdin is funny because of Robin Williams. And we certainly had a lot of reasonably good questions in this episode as well about some silly things, but I still like the movie quite a bit. You're not as much of a fan, but your last thoughts on Beauty and the Beast.
I honestly can't put my finger on why it doesn't turn my crank, other than it's just not my jam. I don't have anything bad to really say about the movie, but I guess I'll just give a voice to all those people out there who are like, I don't know, I just don't really care for it. I don't see what everybody else sees in it.
Well, the AFI sure loved it. There's so many lists. It's one of the reasons I wanted to cover it. It's one of the most rewarded on the various lists films we still have, or until now, had not covered. Anyway, that's the end of Beauty and the Beast. In 7 days, we'll continue our 2021 trend of featuring ladies in leading roles. This time, the movie will also have a woman directing its two young stars. It's Olivia Wilde's Booksmart. Not a movie I loved when I first saw it, but I did laugh, and I want to see Billy Lord again steal that movie and the two young stars, Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Dever, I think is her name. But that movie, as I recall, is about Billy Lord just being hilarious. What a surprise that was. Okay, the coming attractions opinion question. What's the best woman-centric comedy ever made? Meaning, directed by a woman, written by women, starring women. I don't think there's that many that fit those bills, so come as close as you can to a woman-driven project that is also hilarious.
All right, so for the answer to that, check out next week's podcast about Booksmart. You can also find us online at top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 07 list of the best American films ever made, but hundreds more titles on top of that. In exchange for all of this content, you could leave us a rating and a review. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieTheme51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. And that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive. And that will get you a 20% discount.
Bev, we're Beauty and the Beast. Of course, if anyone else calls you Beast, I'll rip their lungs out.
And cut.
Batman reference. I got a Batman reference in the Beauty and the Beast. How about that? Thank you, Jack. If anyone else calls you Beast, I'll rip their lungs out.